Welcome to A Public Affair here on KGNU Community Radio in Denver, Boulder, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Shannon Young. We're spending the month of February looking at various aspects of Black history within the United States. My guest today is Clarence Lussain, a professor of political science and interim political science department chair and director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. Professor Lussain is also an independent expert to the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance and author of multiple books, including The Black History of the White House. His latest book is $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. Professor Clarence Lussain, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Your book, $20 and Change, is a look at the historical accomplishments of Harriet Tubman herself and the effort to put her image on U.S. currency, but also an examination of the through line of African-American liberation struggles to the present day within the United States. But let's start with the first part of your book title, $20. Can you update listeners about where things currently stand with the Tubman 20?
Sure. So as many listeners know, back in 2015, during the Obama administration, there was an announcement from the Treasury Department, from Treasury Secretary Liu, that Harriet Tubman would be put on the face of the $20 bill. This came about because there was a need to update the $5, $10, and $20 bills for security reasons. And taking advantage of that opportunity, Liu proposed that there would be changes to the images on those three currencies, on the $5 bill, Martin Luther King, and Eleanor Roosevelt, Marian Anderson, the opera singer, would be on the back of the $5 bill. And on the back of the $10 bill would be women suffragists, including an image of the very famous 1913 march for women seeking voting rights. But the one decision that got the most attention was to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill and to move Andrew Jackson to the back of the bill. And that itself is also controversial. Not only did Liu begin to look at the issue of having a woman on the bill, but a group called Women on the 20 also was advocating and mobilizing and organizing and had done online surveys and interviews of about 600,000 people. And the consensus individual to rise out of all of that was Harriet Tubman. So all of this happened during the last year or so of the Obama administration, and then it transferred into the Trump administration. So there was some fear because of Trump's well-known antipathy to pretty much anything progressive that it would be derailed, but the decision held, and as a consequence, the projection is that somewhere around 2030, the bill will be issued.
The bill currently features a portrait of Andrew Jackson. I'm sure many listeners are very aware of Jackson's history, but perhaps some haven't given much thought to the backstory of the man featured on that piece of currency. Can you briefly give listeners an overview of who he was and the ideologies he represents?
So Andrew Jackson was the 7th president of the United States, and he is generally given credit for the founding of what became the modern Democratic Party. Part of it was that he lost the 1824 election. He won the popular vote, but he lost in the Electoral College vote. So upset with that, he decided that there needed to be more opportunities for people to vote. But by that, he basically meant white men, particularly white men with property. And so it wasn't an inclusive perspective in terms of who should be participating in American democracy. Individually, he was someone who enslaved people. He made his fortune in many ways through his participation in the slave trade. Also, he was a general at one point and was very instrumental in many of the military attacks on Native Americans, including, and with his own personal participation, in massacres There were Indian villages where U.S. military went in, again with Andrew Jackson in some of the cases, and everyone was killed, men, women, and children. When he became president in 1828, he pushed through the Indian Removal Act, which was basically the final stage in displacing Native people from their original land. And then that eventually led to the Trail of Tears in the late 1830s, in which thousands of Native Americans died on a forced march out of the South and to the West. So, a pretty notorious history. And again, the book is titled Harriet Tubman, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the Ongoing Struggle for Racial Justice and Democracy. And I purposely titled that because I want to demonstrate that Harriet Tubman went beyond just sort of rescuing people from slavery. She escaped from slavery and then bravely and dangerously went back and rescued family members and others. And she also was involved in the Civil War, including leading a military operation. But that's where history usually stops. There was a movie that came out a couple of years ago, really good movie called Harriet. Pretty accurate, but it stopped with her at that military engagement. She lived through 1913, so decades after the Civil War, and much of that history is unknown. And that's what I try to tell in the book, where she was engaged in the women's rights, voting rights, seeking relief for people who had disabilities, as she did, and for helping people who were poor. And all of that to me adds up to her being someone who really, really fought for democracy with a very different vision than Andrew Jackson.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Professor Clarence Lussain about his latest book, $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. As you mentioned, a sizable section of the book details Tubman's historical accomplishments beyond her well-known work with the Underground Railroad. You mentioned the raid. You alluded to the raid on the Combahee River. Can you share that story and what came after in more detail?
So Harriet Tubman contracted with the Union Army after the Civil War broke out to work in the army, basically. She was a nurse, she was a cook, she did cleaning, she was a spy. One role that she took on was as a military leader. She was asked at one point to lead an army of hundreds of soldiers down the Combahee River, which goes down the coast of South Carolina, and basically free people who were enslaved by the Confederates. So the boat sailed and they periodically stopped and got off and freed people who were enslaved and chased away Confederates. She brought back over 800 people who had been enslaved. Not one soldier was killed, not one of the individuals they freed was injured. It was just a amazing operation. And she was the first woman in U.S. history to lead a military operation. So that incident alone just kind of, built on her legacy. And many people would not believe it years later, although, fairly well documented. And the military, celebrated the victory pretty strongly.
And after the Civil War, she went on to become very involved in women's liberation struggles, women's suffrage, and as you note, also the issue of taking care of elders. She built a home that she eventually spent her final days in. And that may also be a part of history that many of our listeners don't already know. Can you share some of those details?
Yeah, so she again was very concerned about, what would happen with people when they became elderly and poor and infirm, which she pretty much, ended up in that situation. She ended up, as you noted, in the home that she built. She had that as a dream of hers for decades, really, and was able eventually to get some funding to do that. Now, again, when we think in contemporary terms, people with image tend to be people who also turn that fame into some wealth, or at least, some degree of being able to live. But it was always a financial struggle for Harriet Tubman. One of the ironies of her being on the $20 bill has to do with her fighting for a military pension. So after the Civil War, pensions were given to soldiers, including Confederate soldiers, people who had basically rebelled against the country. And so Harriet Tubman applied for a pension she had contracted and been in the military, so she wasn't making it up. But she found resistance, and in part it was because people in Congress who would have granted the pension simply did not believe this woman did what she said she did. She had letters of support from all kind of prominent people, including former members of Congress and other political leaders. In the 1890s, Congress did vote her a pension, and that pension was for $20 a month. So again, there's just kind of an irony there. But she was very concerned about what happened to people when their health deteriorated. There's a chapter in the book called From 1619 to COVID-19, and it traces the history of the relationship between African Americans and the health system in the US. During the slave era, there was no concern about the health of Black individuals, only to the degree that people could be working. Harriet Tubman was injured when she was probably 11 or 12. She was hit in the head with some kind of metal object. She almost died. She had bleeding, but she recovered. But she had seizures the rest of her life. She would, it may have been some form of epilepsy. No one knows for sure, but she would just kind of nod out in the middle of a sentence, or have these seizures. So she suffered a disability, which makes it even more amazing when you look at all of the things that she accomplished.
And I'm wondering, from a perspective of a historian, going and finding these details, bringing them back, and it's history that I think in the textbooks is oftentimes ignored. How difficult was it to unearth some of these details?
So it was a challenge. I consulted with many others who had written about her. And part of what I wanted to do was separate fact from fiction. So there are a lot of quotes that are attributed to Harriet Tubman that just were not true. She just did not say these things. So, I really was trying to be careful to dig in and be as accurate as possible. So that meant going to archives, it meant going to the libraries, it meant doing interviews, all of which, you dig and dig and dig, sometimes for years, to make sure you have it right, you have it accurate.
Since your book came out, there's been a push, and it's fairly recent. We're recording this on February 1st of 2023. There's been a fairly recent push to basically outlaw AP African American studies. So you're going from the one side of the spectrum of, what they started out with as trying to keep critical race theory out of colleges. And there were early on warnings that this is basically about teaching anything that goes against the official historical narrative. I'm just wondering about your thoughts on this new offensive to keep some of these historical details that many of us didn't learn in school out of schools altogether.
So yeah, so there's a ongoing campaign essentially to discredit the work been done to create a more inclusive education from pre-K all the way through university and law school. And that effort is, in the service of a conservative agenda, I would argue. And so what it means is finding ways to push back on the gains that people of color, women, LGBTQ people, communities, working communities, working people communities made. And so that requires not only changing policies, but also creating misinformation about the histories of these different communities. And so what we see in Florida, for example, is unfortunately probably becoming the playbook for others around the country. They are quite aware that critical race theory is not taught in any schools outside of law schools, basically, but it becomes a brand that they can use that then triggers panic and triggers a effort to stop anything around racial justice, women's rights, LGBTQ rights, and so forth. And it echoes other eras when terms like political correctness were used along the same ways. And so now we see it with critical race theory, 1619, wokeness. All of those are triggering terms for these attacks on educational progress.
Do you see parallels between these organized attacks on educational progress and this making schools and libraries a new battleground in de facto culture wars? Do you see parallels with in the early 1900s when the Daughters of the Confederacy went about erecting statues all across the South to Confederate generals and changing the historical narrative to that of the lost cause?
Absolutely. So part of how power gets exercised is not just through the physical use of policy or power or through laws, but also through public narrative and through representation. So when the Daughters of the Confederacy and other pro-Confederate organizations begin to campaign and up these statues and monuments, it was to change what was understood clearly during the Civil War, that it had been a war over slavery, a different narrative that now it was about an overreaching federal government. It was about the South defending its integrity, and they want to erase slavery out of that. And so you do that through getting rid of textbooks or any educational material that offer alternative perspective. But the creation of these monuments and these symbols was about those contemporary politics, not about what actually really happened during the Civil War. And then we see it again manifest today, where in libraries, in schools, you have these campaigns again to try to create a different kind of history, or go back to a version of history, that never really existed.
I'm speaking with Dr. Clarence Lussain, professor of political science at Howard University and author of the book, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. So let's bring this full circle back to symbols. You can see that dismantling or taking down some of these Confederate statues that are put up on pedestals in public places in the South, removing names from schools and streets and what have you, has taken more than 100 years to reverse that change in the historical narrative. What importance do you give the portrait of Harriet Tubman on the 20 in that context?
So I think it's very important because it says then that we are going to use this particular narrative space, and that's what it is, to tell a different story than we've been telling all along. That is that for women, for people of color, they matter. Their stories matter, their history matter. The country should be completely represented. And so that is a because there are elements in the country that do not want that story told. And for me, what's of imminent concern is the nexus between what is a rising authoritarian thrust in our politics with a white nationalist element driving it. And so we are really in a battle, not just over images, but really over what direction the country is going to go in. Will it be the kind of democracy that Harriet Tubman envisioned, that was intersectional, that was inclusive, that was really about fairness and justice? Or will it be a version of democracy that really is exclusive and marginalizes people and moves the country backwards decades? And the authoritarianism really has to be taken on. I tell my students that 1923 in Munich, Germany, there was a meeting of the local government in a beer hall. And at one point, the newly emerging Nazi party surrounded the beer hall and attempted to overthrow that government. Does that sound familiar? However, the police and the military moved in and they beat them down. Hitler got away for a couple of days, but he was captured. Now, usually for an act of treason like that, you can often get capital punishment, or at a minimum, you get life in prison. You tried to overthrow the government. But Hitler basically went to jail, prison for less than a year. That's when he wrote Mein Kampf. And 10 years later, he was the Chancellor of Germany. So these movements do not just disappear after losing one battle. They really will continue on until their leadership is basically gone, either in prison or however they may be gone. So we have to be very aware that what happened on January 6th was not the end of it at all. And unfortunately, we see these elements not at the margins, but I would argue that they have penetrated very deeply into the Republican Party.
In your book, you used a term that I think is a lot more accurate than what many in the media had been calling economic anxiety, as far as the rise of Trump and some of these more white nationalist tendencies in political spheres. You called it white replacement anxiety. Can you explain that term?
Right, so there's long, long histories of white nationalism and white supremacy in the country. What has not existed before was the idea that what had been a majority white country would no longer be so. But what the demographics have shown us for the last 30 years is the trend is clearly towards the country becoming a plurality where there will be no one particular racial group, as we define them, that will be a majority. That has created a panic among some because it's seen in zero-sum terms. And you have political leaders who are willing to exploit that particular panic. And so this whole idea of they will not replace us, which was the cry and chant at the August 2017 Charlottesville march and demonstration has continued. And there are lots of data, lots of surveys showing that there's a significant number of people in the country, particularly among whites, who have grappled onto that and have that fear and are willing to see undemocratic policies in order to forestall these democratic changes. So that's really kind of a crisis moment where we're at.
Professor Lusain, we are at the end of our time. I want to ask you if there's anything that you wanted to note that we haven't already discussed that's important to close on.
I just want to note that we should really look at people like Harriet Tubman in as broad a context as possible and learn from them, not only kind of their experiences during their periods, but what they were really trying to do to make the country more democratic, and that really remains the ongoing challenge, not just in the US, but around the world.
My guest today has been Clarence Lusain, a professor of political science interim political science department chair and director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. His latest book is $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy. Professor Clarence Lussain, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to A Public Affair on KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. I've been your host, Shannon Young.